Testing, 1, 2, 3. Yesterday was the beginning of really the start of the month of March, and Mo and I did a lot of our usual running around that we do here in town, you know, paying this bill and that bill, and picking up prescriptions and a few groceries, and just running around like chickens with our head cut off, I guess, which we typically do, deposit money here and take money out there and that sort of thing. Anyway, we decided that to simplify lunch, we would go to the Subway shop, which is, I'm sure as many, most listeners know, is a place where you can get a sandwich for a reasonable price. And we went there and we had a Subway sandwich. We didn't eat it there. We had them pack it up and we took it home and ate it. But we had a Subway club sandwich, and it's nice. The bread's really fresh, and you can get anything on it, hot pickles and lettuce and tomatoes and whatever. But we had what was called the club... What was it called? What is that, Mother? The club what?
Club sandwich.
It was a club, sub-club sandwich. Okay, I'll get it right. Now, what that was slices of roast beef and turkey and ham and cheese. Now, when you ordered the club sandwich, they had this meat all prepared on a piece of wax paper. You know, a couple of slices of ham, a couple of slices of turkey, and so forth. So they could make these sandwiches. I know many people who are listening to me have been in some places, some sandwich places, and they can do this very quickly, and they put a couple of pieces of cheese on. Anyway, we come home and we ate it, and we enjoyed it. We had a bag of potato chips and a glass of milk. But as I was eating it, I remarked, and Margo agreed, that honestly, I could tell a taste of the cheese, which was, I think, some kind of low-fat, like American Kraft cheese, I would suppose, something like that. I could tell the taste of that, but there's no way I could have identified the meats I was eating. I didn't know. I mean, if you said, okay, you've eaten a sandwich, what was on the sandwich? Was it turkey, ham, or roast beef? I don't think I could tell. It was just all sort of, I don't know, tastes all alike to me. Well, this got us to reminiscing about this and that, some long-term and some short-term kinds of things, and that's what I want to talk a little bit about. When we were in Ireland, we had a visit by a woman in our flat who was also a teacher from Central, music teacher, and she was living in Reading, England, very nice person. And she came over and visited us, and one night we served her chicken. And she ate the chicken and she said, gee, that was really nice, except she said, you know, I can't stand the taste of British, also Irish chicken. She said it just really tastes funny to her. Well, and we didn't pursue that much and we didn't say anything, but the truth is that what she was tasting was the taste of real chicken, because this is what they call in England and Ireland free-range chicken. In other words, it's chicken that's allowed to run around in the barnyard somewhere, and then it's, you know, heads to the butcher shop. But it's not this artificially, always in a pen, never allowed to walk around, carefully, scientifically fed chicken that we get in the United States. So we have a chicken here. I guess my point is we eat chicken here and we think it tastes like chicken, but in a way it doesn't taste like the chicken of our childhood, or it doesn't taste like free-range chicken. And I think we don't know what anything, in a sense, what things taste like anymore. We're losing track of that. One of the fun things we did on Kauai, and you know, we just came back from a vacation, a wonderful vacation, 3 weeks on Kauai in Hawaii. Well, Monday through Friday, every day of the week, Kauai has somewhere in Kauai a farmer's market. It's well known, at always at the same place, whatever. And we went to two of them, and we just love these marketplaces. It's and I think maybe we talked a little bit about this. Now, you have to understand, Marco is sort of a half-ass card-carrying vegetarian. She's not a real big fan of eating meat in any case, and she loves vegetables, so these Kauai markets were right down her alley. Now, I will say, for me, a couple of things. One is I bought, and I think we talked a little bit, maybe we talked about this on a tape, but pretty much the unit of cost in these markets was usually a dollar. A dollar for whatever you bought, it was $1. So many tomatoes for a dollar or whatever, everything for a dollar. Or there was some variation of that, maybe a dollar and a half or whatever, but mostly a dollar. And I bought some string beans there in a little package for a dollar. They were I don't know if we call them runner beans here or not. They were thinner than our beans and kind of long. And I cooked those up. I just steamed them or boiled them, I forget which. Nothing fancy because we weren't doing fancy cooking on Kauai. We were on vacation and we didn't have things to do fancy cooking with. And I said, these are absolutely the most delicious string beans I have ever, ever eaten in my life. Now, I'm not a string bean fan, and I know you might say, oh, well, he's exaggerating. I'm not exaggerating. These were the most perfect string bean, tasting string beans I've ever eaten. The other thing we bought is we bought little tomatoes there, and they were absolutely perfect. And in the United States, it's hard to get a tomato that doesn't taste like a Subway sandwich. It's this sort of, it's a perfect tomato. It looks beautiful, has the skin is all right, there's no blemishes on it, but it absolutely is tasteless. It's a designer tomato. These tomatoes we haven't had in Kauai were just absolutely the epitome of what a tomato should taste like. And you know, you just want to say, geez, just with tomatoes and string beans, I want to move where I can just go get this incredible fruit and vegetables. While we were there, we ate Kauai sweet potatoes, and they came in a couple of varieties. One was purple, I think, much smaller than our. Actually, they were yams. They weren't sweet potatoes. And they were, I love yams mostly, but I wasn't crazy about these yams, but they were really dry tasting and quite distinctive in flavor. And then they had Kauai bananas, which were 3-4 inches long.
They were apple bananas.
And they were called apple bananas, as Margot just told me. And they had sort of a banana apple-y taste, quite good. I'm not a big banana fan, but these were really tasty. So I guess what I'm saying is, and also fish. We ate fish. We had fish tonight. We had some codfish tonight. But and then today in the paper, in the Seattle paper, was a long article about how the salmon runs are incredibly down. And I'll tell you, they said, one of the figures stuck in my mind, 1908 was the leading year for canned salmon. Well, that means after 1908, the number of cans of salmon was reduced, down. So now we're in, I think, probably desperate shape over salmon. And for a lot of different reasons. It's not just we're overfished, although that's one of the main problems. But lots of different things. Too many people, too much logging and blah, blah, blah. But what we're increasingly faced with is we're going to eat farmed fish. And, as a matter of fact, they had farmed fish at the markets in Kauai. They grow this little kind of circular little fish that's quite popular there. They were farm fished. Thought, you know, they grow them artificially and they grow extremely fast. So the farming process is as quick as a week. So, but we're going to increasingly have fish that are fed by, I don't know, Purina fish chow, and not out there in the ocean running about exercising and capturing little shrimps and things. And you might think about that. I guess my thesis is this. We are losing the taste of real food, or food that that Margot and I remember as a child or whatever. And we don't even know it. Nobody even knows. The chicken doesn't taste like chicken. And salmon doesn't taste like salmon. And you can't distinguish ham from turkey. And it's just all sort of getting all mushed up and fading away. And nobody notices. And isn't it too bad? P.S. number one. I'm not sure I made it clear. We listened to the tape that Kauai had a farmer's market every day, Monday through Friday, five to five. And they were always in the same place, except they were always in a different place on the island. So the Monday sale was in Lahui, and the Tuesday sale was in Kapa or whatever. And so it wasn't you could go to this one particular place, to the farmer's market, Monday through Friday. You had to know where the Monday market was and the Tuesday market was. In any case, they were extremely popular, so I know a lot of people enjoy going there, and they were cheap. And then, of course, we tried all sorts of experimental things. I can't even tell you the wonderful fruits and things we ate there. But I brought them up and hope we didn't break out with hives. Footnote number two. Margot tells a story when she was a girl. Her mother was a canning fanatic. And, of course, years ago, that was an important way to save money. You canned food. So you could get, buy bushel baskets of tomatoes for example, and can them. Well, I can sort of absolutely close my eyes and see these tomatoes that Mrs. Blanche had bought. They were big, fat, red tomatoes. They had sort of a little, very fine layer of dust or dirt on them. They weren't, like, perfectly clean. And they were imperfect tomatoes. There was a big funky stalk, and there were little green marks, and where the vine was, and all. But these big, imperfect, plump, bursting, sometimes so ripe they'd blow up. And Margot tells a story about she was so enthralled with these tomatoes as a little girl that she would sit and get a salt cellar and go down in the basement, I guess, where her mother canned, and sit next to a bushel basket of these incredibly sun-ripened, perfect, imperfect but perfect, if you will, Michigan tomatoes, and sit there and eat these tomatoes. So she got sick. She got hives, I guess, to eating them. And that's a tomato lover, and that's a real tomato. And it's increasingly harder and harder to find a tomato that has that taste. One of the secrets is it must be vine ripened. It must be vine ripened. If it isn't, it's not good. Canned salmon, to return to that just a little bit. We grew up that the unit of measure for canned salmon was a 1-pound can. that was what a can of salmon weighed. All salmon weighed 1 pound. A 1 pound can of salmon. Somewhere along the line, didn't tell anybody, did this on their own. What they did is some bright young, who knows, we always say Harvard business manager, Harvard school graduate, he decided what they'd do is they would taper the bottom of the salmon can. So now, if you go to the grocery and buy a can of salmon, you'll see that the can is not, the edges are not parallel, but in fact they taper in. It's the same height can, so if you just look at it, it looks like a pound of salmon, a can of 1 pound. It isn't. It's like 14 or 14 and a half ounces. It's just the little chisel you add of this little bit of salmon, even though you're thinking that you're still getting the original amount. We live in a world increasingly, maybe always, I don't know that it's any worse now than it was in 1800 or something, but, and maybe in some ways you can probably make a case it isn't, but a bunch of cheaters and scammers and think they're getting away with something, and often maybe they do and sometimes they don't. The other thing I wanted to say is one of my themes as a teacher as far as students writing papers or book reviews or reviews of art shows or whatever always was a basic thing is the first thing you have to do before you put the pen to paper, as they say, is you have to say, who is my audience? Who am I writing for? So you write one way for a high school class and one way for a college prof and one way for a newspaper, that kind of thing. Well, who is my audience as far as talking this tape? And I think it's sort of everybody that listened to the tape, but I really think a particular focused audience that Margot and I had in mind, Ethan Fitzgerald John and Emma Rose John, I think we're in some ways we're telling them about what's going on, sharing these things with them, because they really are growing up in an age where they can't tell the difference between ham slices and turkey slices and roast beef. And they think that salmon cans, for whatever unusual reason, if they even notice, which they might not, are always tapered towards the bottom. It's always been that way ever since. And the chicken they eat is always tastes like the chicken and that kind of thing. So I want to tell them there are alternatives. There were differences years ago. I heard a National Public Radio segment one evening, and they discussed an art show of poets, I think in Detroit, but not important where it was. And it was called something like the Mimeograph Poets. And what it was is they showed, they were little art, poetry art magazines published, and they were mimeographed and distributed and sold, you know, for not too much money. And somebody saved a lot of these, and I'm sure they collect these items now, and they had a show of this. Well, the point I'm about to make is that the announcers felt obligated to discuss such things as, what do we mean by mimeographing? And they described that. Carbon paper. What was carbon paper? Can't find any more, as far as I know. A common thing, carbon paper. And then I was thinking about reproduction machines, you know, and copy machines of all sorts. And I'm sure that, again, if the audience is Emma Rose and Ethan, they've grown up with these things, sort of, you know, you have a copy machine in your home. We have one connected with our computer. But they're really a fairly recent innovation. And if you think about it, I think the first copy machine I and worked around was a 3M, that's a company, of course, and it was called a Thermofax, thermo being heat, I guess, and fax, you know, copies. It was, and that was, I think, about 1963, right around there. The Thermofax produced a rather yellow, it used an odd paper, let's put it that way, and the paper was rather yellow, and it was just this side of brittle. It wasn't like regular paper, it was extremely thin, and it wasn't a tough paper, it was sort of brittle kind of paper, I don't know how else to describe it. It did not make a great copy, but that, for me, was the first machine. Now, the final punchline of this whole story was, now, these guys were talking factually, they weren't tongue-in-cheek on this, I'm serious about this. They described what a, you know, all these machines, what a mimeograph machine was and that kind of thing. But this man, one of the announcers, actually described a typewriter, a manual typewriter, how there were these things, you know, sort of this thing and it had keys on it and all that. That sounds really silly and say, oh, everybody knows what a typewriter is. But you know, maybe everybody doesn't know what a typewriter is. And I think maybe somewhere way back in the tapes, but I'd say it again if I didn't, I saw a young boy, he was, now I don't remember now, but maybe 8 or something, and he absolutely had never seen a fountain pen. He had never seen a fountain pen. His world was a ballpoint pen. And it's amazing to see this. It was like some kind of like looking at a passenger pigeon or something. Gee, I didn't, what is this? He didn't know how to hold it. He didn't know how it worked. He didn't know why one would have one. Or the whole thing was like a mystery to him. Really strange how things change. And they not only change, but we learn to accept things as change and don't really understand maybe there were all sorts of alternatives. And for instance, we forget that if you go back several hundred years, of course, there was no printing press, no copy machines of any sort. Everything, if you want to copy, it was copied by hand. Somebody sat down, a monk or whatever, sat down and wrote it out longhand. And that's one of the fun things to go see, is to see, for instance, the British Museum, go see the paper bulls that were published. They were handwritten by monks. It's just sort of, wow, you know, incredible. Margot pointed out two things. Thing one is, we had a chance with Ethan when we went to Winchester Cathedral to see the Winchester Bible, which is just, it's just incredibly beautiful. It was big too, and it was in several volumes, as I remember, 4 perhaps. And of course that was all hand done. The most exquisite work of art you've ever laid your eyes on, all copied, I guess, by monks, and now preserved and shown, plus a whole collection of all sorts of handwritten books and manuscripts and like. That was really mind-boggling. The other thing is, Margot said she remembered Thermofax, and the more I thought about it, that I think when the Thermofax paper came out of the machine, it was actually warm. It was physically warm to the touch. And Margot said that's because it was really produced by heat in some way. There's some kind of inky thing or whatever, and heat produced the image of the typing or whatever was on this paper. Now, she also said she had a chance some years ago to go through some really old files, and she found some of these old files had Thermofax copies in them, and she said it absolutely looked like, she said it, they were really brittle, and they looked exactly like they had been in a fire. Not burned in a fire, but, you know, roasted, if you will, somehow, maybe in a metal box or something. And that's exactly what took place, I guess. I think kind of a long story about not very much, but tonight for supper we had a clay pot, and we put all kinds of vegetables in it. Certainly, I don't know what, 8 different kind of vegetables. Centered around, I think, potatoes and onions, but whatever's around the house or whatever we buy. And today, lots of fresh string beans. But anyway, and you put some garlic in it, and olive oil, and roast it in the oven. And it's a real peasant dish, I think. Well, the first time we found out about this was a recipe called Gewetz, or that's at least how we say it, and maybe Hungarian, I guess, or something like that, but probably every peasant country has some kind of roasted vegetable group thing, like we had the Yeeksiness and whatever. But we found out about Gewetz, actually the first Gewetz recipe was from the Great Dinner's Cookbook, Time Life, and I stopped what I was doing a little early and went and looked. It's copyright 1969, so we've had it probably since then. I've always considered the Great Dinners by Time Life to be the best cookbook ever published by the hand of man. Anyway, so that's it's an old peasant recipe, and since then we've been eating it over the years, and maybe you often eat it once a week. Now, that's not what I want to make a point. Margot said, you know, maybe my Margot's appreciation for vegetables was because my mother was a great vegetable cook. And she went on to talk to me about how, especially during World War II, meat was rationed. You couldn't just go down and buy all of hamburger you wanted. There were coupons, and I don't know, some of them were issued rationed and you had to pay so many points for a chicken or whatever, and most folks were, I think, pretty honest about that. They simply, there was some black marketing, of course, and will always be, but well, people were pretty honest. So if you did the interview, and people save coupons, say, oh, I want to, let's have a steak. We'll save all our coupons for this week and that kind of thing. Because all the meat production was going to the military and whatever. But her mothers became really creative about serving all kinds of wonderful vegetable things. And then Margot said, and it's quite likely your mother did too. And I remember my mother doing vegetable things, even as a little kid, the memory of these things. And in fact, Margot and I think, have mutual memories of some kind of a motherly thing about boiled carrots and onions and maybe spinach and potatoes, and you mash them, mush them all up in a plate and feed them to little kids. Oh, eat your spinach and that kind of stuff. We both experienced that. So in fact, that maybe partly this vegetarian thing was brought about by Adolf Hitler, if you want to say, World War II. Let me make a point. Kathy especially, and her sister, Sydney, to some extent are, they're sort of half-ass vegetarians, and Margot's a half-ass vegetarian, too. And they're sort of not all that crazy about meat, but think about the connection. Margot's mother cooking lots of vegetables because she couldn't buy meat, and she could buy vegetables cheaply, you know. And then Margot growing up in this vegetable environment, and then Margot having 2 babies and feeding them, oh, eat your spinach kind of thing. And that the reason that maybe Emma Rose likes vegetables is because of Margot's mother. Think about that. That connection is not invalid.
Margot wants to add a little PS to this discussion about vegetables and meat and whatever.
Well, I was just saying to Quentin that when we were very young, when we had Cindy and Kathy as children in the house, we did not have a lot of money. Our money was limited. And I had to make the best of the grocery money that I could. And so, yeah, we ate a lot of vegetables because vegetables were cheap and easy to fix and selectable.
I think my memory of, I had heard about vegetarians when I was a little kid, and I think my memory of vegetarians was that they were some kind of really weird people, that they didn't eat meat was something made them really strange. And I think I held on to that idea for just a long, long time, that surely a balanced diet, I mean, rationally, I would think, I said, balanced diet has to include meat or fish or something like that, because it always had. So I thought vegetarians were these really strange people. Of course, obviously, I don't know, but, you know, it's taken years to change one's mind. The other thing is, I have to say this little aside, if you will. I think I heard some story about Jehovah's Witnesses or something, and they ate invisible meals. And I remember as a little kid making fun about, oh, let's have a T-bone steak or something. And, you know, I don't know where I got that idea, but... And I think it was easy for a little Catholic kid to come up with all sorts of derogatory stories about other religions, just as I'm sure other religions came up with... I know they came up with horrible stories about